As I indicated this morning, you probably forgot because I forget things like this when I say what I'm going to be talking about tonight, but the question is, what can a man give in exchange for a soul, or what can we give in exchange for our souls? The reason I'm asking this question, this is exactly what Jesus had asked in Matthew chapter 16. And I think the challenge, I mean, there are a number of things you can think about, but one of the challenges is, what is our soul's value? If someone is killed, let's say accidentally, we'll just leave it outside of any sort of criminal activity, but someone dies accidentally, it might be that a company, it might be that a company decides to try to financially provide for the family. You know, they may say, look, this person was this age, they would have worked for us for this long, they would have had this earning potential, and therefore we're going to give you a settlement of, you know, $2-3 million, maybe $10 million. I have no idea how that works, but I know there are people who do that. But that's the value of a person's life as a working person, earning money, and that kind of thing. But the question that Jesus is asking is about the value of our soul. And I think the hard part is, how do you actually measure the value of a soul? And on one side of this is kind of, in my mind, the evangelistic view. You think of Jonah, when he was told by God to go to Nineveh, and he was like, there's just no way I'm going there. Those are horrible people. They're enemies of Israel. I'm not going. And he made it very clear he wasn't going. He decided he'd go the other direction God wanted him to go. And we know how that story goes, that God, you know, caused this great fish to swallow him up and spit him out on the land, and he still didn't want to go. But if he knew the value of a soul, would he have gone? And I don't know. It may be we somewhat think the value of certain people's souls. We might think of someone who's a really good person. They've got high value. Maybe someone who doesn't have any sort of estimation of human life. You know, it's not just that they're a criminal. It's just how they interact with people. Like, nobody is equal to them. You know, we say, they don't seem to have that understanding. And it's not like we're born into this world with some sort of a number tattooed on our shoulder that says, you are worth $5 million. Because you know what would happen? Somebody would go, we need to start selling these babies, you know, because you see their worth on their shoulder with that tattoo. But how do we determine this? Well, what I want to do, we're not reading all three. We're going to read Matthew 16, 24 through 28. But I just wanted to show you that Mark and Luke also have this same thing. John's the only one that does not out of the gospel accounts. And Matthew, Mark, and Luke are essentially the same. There are slight differences in some of the expressions, but essentially they're the same thing. So Matthew 16, starting in verse 24, we'll read to the end of the chapter, and this is a week before his transfiguration. We read that Jesus told his disciples, if anyone would come after me, and notice, he says, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever would save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. For what will it profit a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul? What shall a man give in return for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come with his angels in the glory of his Father, and then he'll repay each person according to what he has done. Truly I say to you, there are some standing here who will not taste death until they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Which I think is a pretty clear indication that the kingdom came in power during the lives of the disciples. I mean, he says some of you. He didn't say all of you, but some of you. So it happened in that generation of time that Jesus was here on earth. But without getting distracted with that pursuit, it's, again, the question, what is the value of our soul? Now, from what Jesus says in this context, you notice there, verse 26, what will it profit a man? What's the gain? If he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul, what shall a man give in return? So it might be that at the very least, the world, as Jesus says here, man gains the whole world. Not even saying what the value is of the whole world. And is he talking about you know, the world in the sense of just the earth itself, or is he talking about everything that's contained therein? In other words, all the animals, all the people, things like that. The word that is used here for world is typical. It's the cosmos. That's the word that's used. And typically when we think of the cosmos, we think more of the universe. We think that way when we hear the word cosmos. We don't just think the world. But in the Greek mind, the world to them was the earth and everything that was in it. All the animals, all the people. And this is the same word that Satan uses with Jesus in Matthew 4. If you'll just kill yourself, or at least try to, by jumping off the pinnacle of the temple, I will give you all the kingdoms of the world. You know, that's kind of what Satan wanted Jesus to do, is take that shortcut. It's the same word that is used there, of cosmos. My point ultimately is this, that the value of our soul, not all of ours together, but all in an individual sense, it's the value of the world itself. Again, what will a man profit if he gains the whole world and forfeit his soul? I'm not saying that that's exactly the equivalency, but that's pretty close from the view of God. And this is the point. We can look at things ourselves and say, well, this person has more value than this person, and determine those valuations on a lot of different things, but not from God's view. From God's view, it doesn't matter who you are. If you are human, you have value. Your soul has value. And it has much value. It's not a little bit of value. I know many years ago there was a published experiment where they took, and I guess what they did is they determined what all elements you have in your body, you know, iron and different things, and what would be the monetary value if you were reduced to all your mineral content. And I forget what it was at the time, but it was under $20. It was like $17 and whatever. And obviously it changes with inflation and all, but that doesn't even come close to the idea that Jesus is trying to convey. The value of our soul, and I know this is hard. This is not an easy discussion for us to go, well, yeah, it's this, it's that. Because Jesus speaks as the value of a soul. If a man gained the world, what would he give if he gained the world and forfeited his soul? What could he give to exchange for his soul? The Lord doesn't go on to say, well, he could give the world. That would be the same thing. Because I don't even know if that's exactly what he's trying to say. I think what he's saying is the value of a soul is tremendous. It's valueless. It's so valuable that we can't really put some sort of a price on it. And so, yes, as I'm indicating in this, Jesus seems to indicate our soul's value is worth more than the world, the cosmos, as it would be used here, or even like Satan used it in Matthew 4. I'm the sort of person who I know everybody's different, for me, if someone said, look, we're going to talk about how much time means more to me than money. I mean, money means something. I can't say money doesn't mean something, especially when you don't have a lot of it, you start thinking about money more. But if someone said, look, you do this thing, and this is one of the ideas, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime, right? And we hear that. I've seen it on bumper stickers sometimes, you know, and it is not a deterrent to everybody. There are some people who are like, yeah, I can do the time. I know I can't, so I don't, it's not like that's the reason I don't do crime, you know. I don't sit there every day thinking, man, if only I could do the time, then I would do the crime. I don't think that way. But time means quite a bit to me, and so I think of it in this way. The value of time and what that means in perspective of what we're talking about tonight, about the value of our soul. What I want to do is turn over to Matthew 18. So where we are in Matthew 16, we've got a page or two maybe to turn to Matthew 18, and we're going to start our reading there, verse 21. And what we find here is, of course, Jesus, as he has taught them about your brother sinning against you, you go to him and tell him his fault between you and him alone, and so on and so forth. And then immediately Peter comes up, verse 21, and said, Lord, how often shall my brother sin against me? So it's not just your brother sins and you're going to go tell him his fault. It's he sins against you you're going to confront him about this, and if he doesn't repent, then you have a process. Peter wants to know, how often shall this happen? This is a big process. How often should it happen? And I forgive him, as many as seven times. And I don't think it's an arbitrary number. I don't think Peter just threw a number out. It happened to be seven. Seven was a significant number to the Jewish mind. Greeks also had the same sort of thinking. Numbers meant things to them. When you think of the number 666, everybody attaches to it some kind of a weirdness, but it's the number six three times. It's not 666, it's 666. It's one less than seven three times. God is described as seven. Anytime in Revelation, God is described, there's seven eyes, seven spirits, 777 is used over and over again. That's the signification. So six is one less. And when it's three times, it's trying to duplicate God as a Trinity, the Father, Son, and Spirit. So that's how the Greeks worked with numbers. Well, the Jews did very much the same thing. And you think about it. I mean, there's a signification to the number 12, 12 tribes, 12 disciples. You've got the number 40. That's a full number, longer than a month. And you think of it, Jesus who fasted for 40 days. The flood was for 40 days. What is the significance? It's a complete number, a large number. 1,000 hills, you know, it's limitless. Here we're talking seven. Seven is a holy number. But Jesus' reply to him is not, well, yeah, seven sounds good. He says, I don't say seven times, but seven times 70. Now, translationally, it is different. The ESV says 77 times. Most all English translations say 70 times 7. So the idea is 490. But it's what we call hyperbole. The point isn't we keep track of everybody's faults against us, and when we get to 491, we let them have it. Because that's pretty much an impossibility. I'm not going to say it's totally impossible, because I actually know one guy, a preacher, who keeps records of people. I'm not kidding. It's really bizarre. It's just like, I told him when I found that out, and I did. I was young, had no idea what I was saying, because you say things sometimes. I just said, you need to get a life. And he turned around and started writing something. I'm like, yeah, that's great. I'm in his book, you know. Verse 23, the kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who wished to settle accounts with his servants. Now, this is like tax time, you know? And so when he began, he was brought to him, or one was brought to him who owed him 10,000 talents. Now, we know that's a lot of money, but what does that mean? If someone today says 10,000 talents, I have to sit down and kind of think about this. The footnote that I have in the ESV just basically says that a talent was a monetary unit worth about 20 years of wages. That makes sense to me, because it doesn't matter the value of the money, you know, $1 million, $2 million. When you're told that one talent would take you typically 20 years of your life to pay or to earn, I'm 55, so I have not yet come to the point of three talents. I'm getting close, but I'm not there yet. That's a lot. That's a lot of money. And so this guy, however he does it, owes the king a lot. To just show you this, verse 24, he's owing 10,000 talents, a talent being 20 years. 10,000 talents times 20 years. And yes, I used a calculator to try to be accurate. If I did this in my mind, I can't do it. 200,000 years. Now, my first question is, how did the guy get to a point that he owes the king that much time? I mean, money or time, however you want to see it and however you were looking at it and say, wow. Either way, if someone said 200,000 years of existence is what you need to pay the guy back, where do you start with that? Or 10,000 talents, or however you want to have that expressed. If you're doing a little bit more math, 200,000 years, if you divided it into hundreds of years as a lifetime, which I don't know that most of us are going to reach 100. 100 is still rare. But if we went with 100 years, you're talking 2,000 lifetimes. Have I got your attention yet? I mean, the point is this enormity. It's not just some large number that you're like, wow, that's a big number. Like when you hear of a baseball player who signs a contract, Shohei Ohtani, you know, he's a fantastic baseball player. He's not just a guy who hits baseballs well. He's a fantastic pitcher. He's a fantastic hitter. He's like the Babe Ruth of modern times, and he's getting paid bajillions of dollars. I mean, it's like, it's astounding. Between two players, both from Japan, by the way, the LA Dodgers are paying $1 billion every year for these two guys. Almost all that money goes to Shohei. The other guy gets a small amount, but it still adds up to about $1 billion a year. That's insane for baseball, you know? I love baseball, but nobody's worth that kind of money. I don't care. But the LA Dodgers are like, yeah, these guys are. And still, what does that mean to us? If I told you, like we just have gone through this, 2,000 lifetimes to pay back anybody, where do you even begin? And so, like in 2 Corinthians 5 and verse 10, we're reminded that we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ so that each one may receive what is due for what he has done in the body, whether good or evil. If you know 200,000, you know, years of good coming, heaven, because you've done well, well done, good and faithful servant, 200,000 sounds wonderful, right? But 200,000 years of being punished, that sounds like an eternity. And I think that's exactly how it's conveyed here in Matthew 18. And that's the point. As Jesus says, this guy, this made-up guy, owes the king 10,000 talents. He owes 200,000 years of time. And so the master ordered him to be sold. Like, that's going to do anything. His wife and his children, everything that he had, and payment be made. And so the servant fell on his knees, verse 26, imploring him, begging him, have patience with me. Really? Give me time. Okay, I'm telling you, you owe me 200,000 years. Give me time. I'll pay it all back. I mean, that's what he says. Have patience with me and I will pay you everything. Talk about empty words. Out of pity for him, the master of the servant released him and forgave the debt. The idea is the entire debt. And when the same servant went out, he found one of his fellow servants owed him 100 denarii, which is about 3 months, a little bit more than 3 months. Whatever you earn in 3 months, that's what he owes his fellow servant. So it's not nothing. I heard people talk about, oh, it's hardly anything. Well, compared to 200,000 years, yes, it's nothing. But it's 3 months. I don't know that I've ever owed anybody 3 months of a salary. It's not no money. That's a lot of money. And so he seizes him. He chokes him. And he says, you need to pay me what you owe. And his fellow servant fell down and pleaded with him. And he said the same thing. Have patience and I'll pay you. And he refused. He just said no. And threw the guy in jail. Debtor's prison is what we call it. I say nowadays. Debtor's prison. I don't know. It's been quite a long time since our country's had that. But in verse 31, when his fellow servants saw what had taken place, they were greatly distressed. I mean, this really upset them. Because they knew the valuation of 200,000 years of time owed the king, and now 3 months, and you're not willing to forgive the way you got forgiven? And they went and reported to the master everything that had taken place. In verse 32, his master summoned him. Can you imagine? You've already been released from everything from the king, and now the king calls you back in. I don't think that would be a moment of triumph. That would be a moment of distress. You wicked servant, I forgave you all that debt because you pleaded with me. Should you not have had mercy on your fellow servant as I had mercy on you? And in anger, that's what the ESV has, verse 34. I like the King James here because it says the king was wroth. When you see the word wrath, I always think of a cross-eyed angry. It's not wrath. It's related to the word wrath, but he was wroth. He's just so angry he can't see straight. And that's not the literal definition, by the way. That's just the definition I think of when I think of someone who's wroth. They can't even think now. They're so angry. We talk about things like that, you know, and he's wroth. He is so angry at this guy. And he delivered him to the jailers until he should pay all his debt, which means he spent the rest of his life in prison. So also, my heavenly Father is going to do to every one of you, Jesus says, if you don't forgive your brother from your heart. That's a simple point, but that's a really hard point. I know people, they are bitter, they hang on to things for years, and it's like, it's their burden. It's not my burden anymore, it's theirs. That's not good. The valuation of time. What is your soul worth? Well, just putting pieces together from what we read in Matthew 16, it sounds like the cosmos is equivalent to your soul. A man could gain the whole world. What would he give in exchange for his soul? If he gains the whole world and forfeits his soul, he just gives it up. What would he give to get it back? So it's worth at least that. Each one of us, not all of us put together, or the entire planet of 8 billion plus people, that's the valuation, the whole... No, he's like, each one of you is worth this. Which kind of helps us understand, maybe, a better perspective of why Jesus was so willing to die for us. Because from his view, each one of us is worth the cosmos. And that's the divine perspective. That may not be the way we look at it, but we should try to look at it that way. And then here in this parable, it's just the idea, eternity. How would you express it? I would express it 200,000 years or 2,000 lifetimes. That just seems like an overwhelming amount of time. And when Jesus comes to this earth, he doesn't tell us, look, I'm here just to make it all warm and fuzzy. In Matthew 10... it's not peace that Jesus said that he came to bring, but a sword. He came to divide. And we don't want to think about that. It's hard to think about that. I think most people have the idea in their minds that Jesus is a peace-loving person. He wants there to be peace. I'm not trying to contradict that concept except for what Jesus says here in this context, that he didn't come to bring peace. He came to divide. Matthew 10, 34 through 39, don't think that I've come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law. And a person's enemies are going to be those of his own household. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me. I think part of the reason why he chooses this as an illustration, basically, of what kind of love we're supposed to have for him is because most people get the love of a father or the love of a mother. We understand that. We're like, oh yeah, we get that. And he says, if you don't love me more than your dad, you don't love me more than your mom, then you are not worthy of me. Whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. Whoever does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Your value is nothing if you don't love me the way you should. And he says in verse 39, whoever finds his life will lose it. And whoever loses his life for my sake will find it. That sounds paradoxical, but that's how God sees these things. The valuation of your soul is the world. Again, thinking about time, what's 2,000 lifetimes of worth? Why did Jesus come to die for you? Because he saw you had value. Every one of us has that value. It's not one value that is greater than another. It's not like that's the idea at all. It's we have equal value, but our value being equal doesn't mean that it's all the same zero, because it's not. It's worth the world. It's hard to watch somebody who gives up. You know, they give in to Satan. Why? Because they're having a tough day. It's devastating when you hear of someone who has taken their own lives because they've found and followed a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And that's what suicide is. My great aunt, she killed herself, and I can't tell you the grief that is still attached to what she did. I don't think about it all the time, but I do think about it relatively often. Just things come up and things remind me of her, and I think of what she did. And you know, I'm not one to judge because I'm just not to judge, but it's devastating. That's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And I want us to think, because spiritual suicide is as effective. It is a permanent solution to say, I'm going to leave the Lord because I'm having, what, a bad day? Or I'm having a bad week. Maybe you're having a bad year. I think many of us would say, you know what, the last few years have been bad. You know, there are some who are like, oh yeah, it's been great for me. That's kind of a rare thing. You know, whether it's the finances or just the general stress of life, whatever it is, things haven't been great, but it's a temporal situation. Even if you had a lifetime compared to 2,000 lifetimes, what's one? You know, doing math, you could divide one by 2,000 and come up with a great number, and it's a very small thing. But think of the frustrations and the distresses, the injustices you feel like you've gone through. Is it really worth losing your soul for all eternity because you're unhappy? I don't know what it is exactly, because the Constitution of our country doesn't say that we all have a right to happiness. We have a right to pursue happiness. But we've come up with the idea, generally, that we have a right to be happy, whatever that is. And anybody standing in my way is an obstacle, and I'm going to take care of them or remove them. Or, you know, how many marriages dissolve because people aren't happy? Okay. I was reading Psychology Today, I think this was a month or two ago, that in most marriages that last 30, 40 years, you're going to have an average of 5 to 7 years of unhappiness. Nobody tells you that when you're saying your I do's, right? I mean, you don't stand there and the preacher goes, all right, 5 to 7 years, going to be bad, going to be really bad, for whatever the reason. But we don't think that. But in the middle of it all, it's like people are like, I quit, we're going to get divorced. What? What's that? Because it's temporal. It's a permanent solution, really, to a temporal problem. Why do we think that way? Why spiritually just give up? And that's why John reminds us, don't love the world. It's the same word, cosmos. So the worth of our soul is more than the cosmos, but that's why John tells us, don't love it. Don't love the world. It is passing away, which is a phrase we use for someone who has died. They passed away. 1 John 2:15, and I know most of us know this passage, don't love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. All that is in the world, desires of the flesh, desires of the eyes, pride of life. I know this sounds kind of weird, but I mean, we all go through seasons in life where maybe when you're young, there's certain desires. I'm not just saying sexual, just desires. I remember the first car that I bought, the first car I got was a Chevy Impala 68. If I knew what I had, I would have really worked hard to keep it. My dad gave it to me because it was kind of a junk car. It needed new paint, needed a new engine, but it was my first car. My grandfather bought me a Dodge Omni, which is one of the worst cars on the planet. Just horrible, horrible car. It lasted for like 6 months before things, major things started happening to it. And I hardly did anything with it. So I bought a Volkswagen Jetta, traded it in. I got burned on it because I knew nothing about anything. Traded it in and paid way too much, I know. Looking back on it, it was a bad decision. But I love that car. It was a Volkswagen Jetta Karat, which means nothing to most humans. But the word Karat, you know, special word. And what they had, it was a 5-speed manual transmission, which I loved. I adored that. And it had a moonroof, and it had a really nice stereo system. You know, back when I was 18, 19 years old, those were things that really, really mattered. And when I bought it, I brought it to church, and of course all my other friends who were about my age came up and like, wow, it's beautiful, it's nice, can we sit in it? They wanted to smell it and then play with the roof and all. This old farmer guy walks by and he's like, it's just a car. Man, you talk about rain on a sunny day's parade. I mean, it was like he just threw the whole thing out. What? So I ignored him. You know, that's what you do. But as time goes, and I think back on that car, I'm thinking, that was just dumb. Really, it was. And, you know, I like motorcycles now much more than cars. I see cars, and there are very few cars I see that I'm like, yeah, that's a nice-looking car, but I know I can't afford it. Eh, whatever. I'd rather have the nice motorcycle. But there's certain motorcycles now, I just don't care about them. They're just, the valuation in my own mind is different. It's not about being loud anymore. It's about maybe going fast, you know, that kind of thing. And that will change too, because that's the desires of life. And I know that all of us know this. Maybe the younger we are, we don't know it as well. But the older you get, do you know that what John is saying here is right, that the desires of the flesh, they're different now than they were. Now it might be our desire for the flesh is just to have health, you know. Just, we're happy if we're healthy. Younger, we don't think that way so much. The desires of the eyes, things that we see that we just fall in love with. Pride of life. He says that that's not from the Father, it's from the world. And the world is passing away along with its desires, and whoever does the will of God abides forever. And again, thinking with evaluation of time, we're talking, you know, if someone said, look, your existence is going to be 2,000 lifetimes, it's hard to put that in mental perspective and say, 2,000? What? But again, going back to Matthew 18 and thinking through the numbers just that way, it shows you the enormity of the entire thing. And so I want to close with this passage. I know we've been using this passage a little bit lately, at least I've noticed myself going to it. But in 2 Corinthians 4:16, we're going to read through chapter 5 and verse 11, Paul talks about things that really do matter. He says, in great context, about this treasure of the gospel, what do we contain it to? Jars of clay. I mean, that's what he's saying here, starting in verse 7. We have this treasure in jars of clay to show that the surpassing power belongs to God, not us. And as he goes on in verse 16, we don't lose heart. We don't give up. We don't faint. We don't quit. Even though the outer man is wasting away, the inner man is being renewed every day. For this light momentary affliction is preparing for us an eternal weight of glory beyond all comparison. All comparison, he says. As we look not to the things that are seen, but to the things that are unseen. The things that are seen are transient or temporal, but the things that are unseen are eternal. How many of us have seen heaven? Obviously none of us have. God describes heaven in Revelation 21:22 as a place I'd like to see. I'd love to see. And so it's eternal. Everything we see with our eyes right now is temporal. Everything. Even the mountains, even the sun, everything. And then he goes on in chapter 5, verse 1, we know that if the tent that is our earthly home is destroyed, we have a building from God, a house, not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. In this tent we groan, longing to put on our heavenly dwelling, if indeed by putting it on we may not be found naked. For while we're still in this tent, we groan, being burdened, not that we would be unclothed, but that we would be further clothed, so that what is mortal may be swallowed up by life. He who has prepared us for this very thing is God, who has given us the Spirit as a guarantee of it. And so we are always, and I want you to notice verse 6, we are always of good cheer or good courage. He doesn't say often we find ourselves happy. He says we are always of good courage. We know that while we're at home in the body, we're away from the Lord, for we walk by faith, not by sight. Yes, we are of good courage, and we would rather be away from the body and be at home with the Lord. So whether we are at home or away, we make it our aim to please Him. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may receive what is due for what he's done in the body, whether good or evil. Therefore, knowing the fear of the Lord, we persuade others. But what we are is known to God, and I hope it's known to your conscience, he says. What are we? That goes back to the very beginning in our question that Jesus had asked for us is, what can we give in exchange for our soul? If a man gains the entire world and forfeits his soul, what could he give in exchange for his soul? Obviously, if he's gained the world, he can't do that because he forfeited his soul in gaining the world. Can he now give that and get his soul back? I don't think that's the answer that Jesus is saying. Well, just make that trade. It doesn't happen that way. The valuation that God gives to our soul, I think, is probably much more than we give to our own. We might not think it's all that valuable, right? But that's what God, I think, is trying to say in the number of passages we've kind of looked at, is we are worth more. And remember when Jesus talks in Matthew 6, don't worry about what you're going to wear, what you're going to eat. And he talks about how we are worth more than many sparrows. How many sparrows is the world worth? I mean, again, that's what God says. Your soul, worth what value? That value of the world itself, that if you gained it and forfeited your soul, what would you have to give in exchange for your soul? God has done much for us. And it's not just giving us things and, you know, money, food, and all that. He's given us a soul, and he wants us to spend time with him. That's the value. Now, you think in John 14, when Jesus tells the apostles, I'm going to prepare a place for you. What kind of place? It's not a shack. You know, if I had to prepare for all of you to come to my house and live in my house, y'all wouldn't have much space. I mean, you just wouldn't, practically. Don't have much space to offer. Don't have much to offer in that regard for all of us. Maybe a few, but not many. But here Jesus says to the apostles, I'm going to prepare a place for you, and I'm going to come back and receive you to myself, that where I am, there you may be also. Not, I'm preparing a place that I can put you, and I'm going to be far away. He says, I'm preparing a place, and I'm coming back, and I'm going to receive you to myself, that where I am, you may be also. That's a high value that God places on each one of us. How dare we just throw it all away because we're having problems or we don't see how things might work out. They're going to work out. God gives us that promise. We don't know exactly how this plays out, but we do know God wants us to be with him. And so if you're not a Christian, you've not been baptized, you've got to take that first step. You have to. You can't just say, one day I'm going to, because you don't know what a day is going to bring. We know that every day we hear news and we're like, man, I didn't see that coming. Maybe you do see some things coming, but you don't see everything coming. You just don't know. But Jesus will receive us. As the song indicates, sinners, Jesus will receive. This is God's grace to each one of us, and he wants us to be with him forever. He's done so much for us, giving his own son to buy us, to purchase us. That's what Acts 20, verse 28, he purchased the church with his own blood. That means that's how much it means to him. That's how much you and I mean to him. If you want to be baptized and be saved by God's grace, right now, please come forward as we stand and sing.